Good afternoon. I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. First on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Coulter, have you had the opportunity to review and approve the minutes?
I sure have, Madam Chair, and I will move approval.
All right. Representative Coulter moves approval of the March 18th minutes. Any discussion to that motion, members? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And the minutes are approved. All right. First bill up today is House File 2362. Representative Feist, I just do want to note for everyone in the audience today, we do have a packed agenda, so we're going to try to keep testifiers moving along. We appreciate you all joining us and sharing your expertise and passions, but we just have to kind of keep moving at a good clip today. So, Representative Feist, I will move House File 2362 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, and go ahead with your bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. You all know me as the person who walks into this room by mistake and thinks it's the Public Safety Committee and then walks out. I do that a lot. So anyway, glad to be here on purpose today to present House File 2362, which funds YIPA and the YIP grants, the Youth Intervention Programs Association. This is a program along with all of the youth justice programming and funding that is migrating from the public safety realm to the children and families realm. So I'm really excited to introduce it to all of you today. This is a really amazing program that funds youth intervention programs and has since the mid-70s when it was created in a bipartisan way. They funded 98 programs from across the state, and I would really encourage you all to look in your packets. There are 38 letters from YIP grant recipients just talking about all of the really varied programs that they provide kids from across the state. It is truly remarkable. There were 52 additional programs that did not receive funding that Paul here would have loved to give funding that were up to the standards of the YIP grant, and that is why we are here today. These programs, they save money. They keep kids out of jail. That is why this funding was in the public safety realm. But one of our testifiers here will talk today about why we are moving this type of funding and this type of programming back to the children and families and child wellness realm. And I'd like to thank Representative Nelson, who's a co-author on this bill. Pine County does really remarkable work, keeping kids out of the system when they get system involved, helping them get out in a really just like remarkable way. So I've had an opportunity to tour their programs and see them in person. So thanks for being a co-author. I also would point folks to the report that the YIPA program provided, which we created last term in our legislation, just so that we could get more of an understanding of the program, what it does, and the impact that it has. And with that, I will turn it over to the experts.
All right. One thing I need to do, members, is this is the one bill that isn't going to judiciary, so I'm going to re-refer. We're just going to lay it over, so no re-referral, and we also do have a quorum present for the record. Your first testifier, introduce themselves for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Minier. I'm the Executive Director of the Youth Intervention Programs Association. Typically, everybody calls us YIPA because it's so much easier than to say that whole mouthful of stuff. It is a wonderful opportunity to have a chance to speak with you. I could speak for hours about the importance of supporting young people, but I have less than 2 minutes, so I'm just going to say basically hi. We've been down at the Capitol for 30 or 40 years promoting the idea of keeping kids out of the juvenile justice system. And for the last couple decades, we've been in the public safety realm. And so I got to know all those legislators really well, and I feel really off guard not knowing many of you. So I look forward to meeting you and getting to know you better. I am a psychologist by trade. For years, I worked directly with young people that were at risk of going into the juvenile justice system. And if I could just leave you with one thought about what it means to work with them, it is not rocket science. It is really just about building a trusting, caring relationship with a young person that often doesn't have one. So many of our young people are growing up with toxic stress, trauma, or abuse, incarcerated parents, alcoholic parents, caregivers that are absentee, whatever the situation is, that's what our programs do. And they're local level programs. I have kind of a soft spot in my heart for the more local it is, the smaller it is, often the bigger the impact, because we just want to connect with these young people and give them a sense of agency, an idea that they have a place in this world. That's what we're looking to do. So I'll say one more thing, and then I'll turn it over to the other testifier, Bernadette, with me today. I just want to make this really clear because it's so confusing to everybody. So we're talking about the Youth Intervention Program grant. That's what the bill is about. That's what Representative is authoring. We're the Youth Intervention Program Association. So it's the YIP bill, which is why our association exists in the first place. That grant started in 1976, and then in 84, those original grantees said, this stuff is so important, and all these kids are entering the juvenile justice system. We should really form an association. So the difference between YIP and YIPA is that we're the association, and I'm the executive director of that. YIP is the grant program. And we do not administer the grant. The Department of Children, Youth and Families, I'm not even really sure the dynamics yet, who's going to be offering that request for a proposal, but we don't. So I look forward to meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mounier. Ms. Foe, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Bernadette Foe. I'm the Executive Director of Mediation and Restorative Services, a nonprofit that provides both mediation and restorative practices and housing resource navigation in Anoka County and surrounding cities. We also have a statewide footprint. The primary purpose of the YIP program is to provide restorative services in schools, which is a conversation-based approach and form of conflict resolution. Students learn to come to a mutually agreed upon solution that really helps them to have a self-determined and vested input in that process. Now, what we want to do is to really showcase how our process supports both educators and students to utilize the restorative practices to resolve conflicts, which has the power to improve relationships throughout the school, improve the school climate, reduce truancy, reduce desperate disciplinary action, and also ensure that the students themselves have a voice and are engaged in the process. This has proven to be very, very successful. And at the end of the day, the school staff learn and adopt these processes from our staff, making them a sustainable process in a school district once widely adopted, and it improves outcomes for students. So things like truancy, where traditionally it's a punitive approach, we now look at the root cause analysis. We provide options and solutions that actually target the exact problem and not further complicates that. So we are the vehicle and the conduit of success for the YIPA program or the YIP grant. And so today I want to encourage you to fully fund the YIP bill to support the success of young people throughout Minnesota, because their success is actually the success of all Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your time. We have a third testifier, Miranda Sheffield, the National Center for Youth Law, who is in town just for the day. So lucky us. Please approach the table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so very much for having me here today, Chair. My name is Miranda Sheffield. I work with the National Center for Youth Law. I'm here in support of the YIPA bill. One of the things I really wanted to stress is that this opportunity to move this bill forward provides us a way from moving funding from public safety to children and family services, which I think is a major component of this, mostly because it gives us an opportunity to reimagine how we are addressing harm and things that are taking place with young people. And being able to move this also creates different pathways in how we address harm. And so I really encourage this committee to think about that piece and like how transformative it is to be able to move funds from one area to another and what type of opportunity it provides. And I would say another thing, too, how cost-effective it is. We all know that we have young folks who are having different issues and challenges that they're facing, but the thing that we need to consider is when we are wanting to have opportunities for accountability and things are taking place, it needs to be done in a manner that is restoring folks to their humanity rather than wanting to be punitive to them. And I think that is the biggest challenge that is we're wanting to overcome. And also, as someone who is really big with addressing economic concerns, I think this helps us create preventative pathways rather than trying to solve the challenges that have already taken place. So thank you so very much for having me here today. I greatly appreciate it, and I'm definitely looking forward to supporting this work with Representative Feist and with YEPA and the folks there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. All right. Do we have anyone in the public who wishes to testify on House File 2362? Seeing none, we'll move to member testimony. Any discussion, members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Feist and Chair Katizawatun. This is something that I'm a co-author, so I do support it. But it's, you know, seeing the results that I've seen in Pine County with, you know, the restorative justice, you know, trying to really I think it's a very good program to be able to do that. And, you know, as we try to duplicate the work that's happening in Pine County across the state and across the nation, what we're seeing there is, you know, there is a place and time for punitive action, but I think, that's a very small group of youth that really need that. There is a place for it. But I think many of them, unfortunately, we want to wrap too many people into the punitive action. There's a negative effect that goes across, and it's generational as well. And I think if we can start changing some of that narrative is important. So thank you for this.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly am aware of the great work that you're doing with the program. It does appear, though, are we making progress? I see the report here. I haven't had a chance to fully look through it. We just got it. But when you look at the news and you see just a lot of alarming of the youths that are causing trouble and that are arrested, and it's disheartening that, you know, we're doing this great work. Matter of fact, my father, I think, was one of the supporters back in the 1970s. Cool. With this legislation back in 1984 as well. But are we making progress with this as well? Just the news, sometimes it's best to shut it off, but sometimes it's disheartening. Are we really getting to the core issue?
Representative Feist.
And making a difference.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. You know, I have had the privilege to tour juvenile probation programs across the country as part of the different nonpartisan groups that, like, give us opportunities to learn. And Minnesota is really unique in these YIP grants. The way that we create funding on a sustained level for these types of local programs, like you heard just one example, and we also last term created the Office of Restorative Practices with Youth Restorative Practices grants. And we know, like, the data is so clear about how this can reduce truancy. I want to say, like, 10 counties across the state use these types of interventions and youth programming to reduce, like, truancy. And we see how that's impactful. So they're, like, in my mind, we need to fund these types of grants. Like, we know that 52 programs that could do this good work, that could get, you know, struggling kids on back on track. That is how we have that macro level impact. And I've had the privilege to sit in on one of the YIP grant recipients programs. It was a handful of kids with their mentors who had been referred by social workers, by schools, you know, and they were, you know, we were in a house in Minneapolis, and instead of being, like, out causing trouble, like, not, you know, without any direction, these kids were in a safe space, like we were all drawing comic book characters together. And, you know, those programs happen on that super local level, but they're very structured and they create lasting relationships with these kids. So, like, we just need really sustained levels of funding. And you are privileged that all of this funding is coming from public safety into this children and families realm. And I hope that we can build on the success that we've seen on the local level to, like, create these, like system-wide impacts, because we have work to do.
Representative McDonald, any follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, very good. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome to that post. This is awesome. And thank you, Representative Feist. I am a longtime supporter of intervention programs, especially the ones that deal almost exclusively with at-risk youth in the juvenile justice system. I do, as I'm looking through here, I'm not all that familiar with this group. There's a number of programs in here I recognize. And so as supportive as I am of the overall, I'm also just as equally critical of the deliverables, of those things that we're evaluating, those interventions that we can put a finger to, other than you know, there's a lot of you know, support documents here, and it's pretty easy to get support documents from people we give money to. That's not difficult. And so what I'm really interested in is if you can share with the committee. And I'll just pick one. It's the Bridge for Youth is pretty common, Minneapolis one. And, you know, in here it's early intervention, juvenile diversion. Can you just, and maybe you don't know, and you can say you don't know specifically, and I can reach out as well. But, you know, what are those typical deliverables that we're looking for? Not outputs, it's outcomes that I'm always focused on. Can you share a little bit about those deliverables in these programs?
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. I am going to pass it to Paul, but I would just say that we did create a really great report requirement for YIPA last term so that we could get more deliverables, we could get more larger context about what is happening with this funding. And then also I would point you to the Office of Restorative Practices, which is youth focused, which again will be like collecting data and sharing data, because I agree with you. Like I was thinking about, I was like, gosh, we fund such great programs, but God, we have like some of the worst racial disparities in our juvenile justice system in the whole country. So like, what is going on? Like, where is that disconnect? So I agree with you. I want to understand the impact as well. And I'm going to turn it to Paul, who actually has an answer, I'm guessing.
Mr. Meunier.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. First of all, I'll preface it by saying it's really hard to measure a negative. And it's hard to say we stop somebody from committing suicide, stop somebody from getting in a fight, shooting at a school, all those kinds of things. Those things are happening, but we can't measure those. And that's the hard part about trying to really articulate what the outcome is. But we do have good data, and our programs are much more specific about what those data are. The YIP grantees are very diverse in how they work. You chose the Bridge for Youth. We also have the Moorhead Police Department, the Northfield Union of Youth, which is an after-school hangout. They do such different ways of connecting with the young people. And they do have their own outcomes. Just today, before this meeting, we were talking with the Youth Service Bureau in Stillwater, and they partner with Washington County, and they did a long-term study, and they found that the kids that were in their program, the following year, 90% of them did not reoffend, and they got referred to the program because they offended. Those kinds of things are happening all over the place. And it's hard for us at a global level because the programs are so different. So what we did is we have an outcome survey, and it's based on the Search Institute. It was a worldwide research institute that says, what are the protective factors that help young people have a productive youth development and grow up to be contributing members of the community? And there's these things called youth protective factors. And what we did is we compared that to the millions of reports that they had all over, and we found that if you can measure those, that's universal across all the different types of programs they have. And that's what we have in the report there. And I think it was like 67% of the young people reported it helped them make better decisions. 62% it held them accepted accountability for their actions and make better choices. Those are the kinds of things that are really having an impact. And if I may,
Mr. Bunyan,
can I address Representative McDonald's question as well?
Certainly.
You ask a really loaded question, and I think it's an absolutely fair question. And I will tell you that there are so many young people growing up without the support that they need. And we are definitely making progress, but the problem is there's a hole in the boat. And the pressures on families and societies and things like that are growing the numbers of young people instead of reducing them. But we certainly have story after story after story about young people who, instead of going down a life of crime or alcoholism or abuse or whatever that might be, they are now productive adults, you know, with their own employment, their own health care, their own ability to manage their lives. And one person, think of the cost of one person, how much that costs the state of Minnesota if they grow into an adult and they need all these social services. This is what we're avoiding. So I think we are definitely making progress. And I hope I answered both of your questions. Thank you for allowing me to address them both.
Thank you, Mr. Munier. Representative Nadeau, do you have a quick follow-up?
Yes, and thank you for that. I just also want to point out that most of these, at least the ones that are functioning in Hennepin, also have more, they have additional contracts that are leveraging, I hope, these, and we're building bigger, more robust, more effective programs, identifying those interventions that actually help. And then next time when you come back, bring some of those stories with, bring those people back with, so that others can see the effect of that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. All right. We have Representative Hemington-Yeager, followed by Representative Perez-Vega, and Representative McDonald wants to ask another quick question. Go ahead, Representative Hemington-Yeager.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. When I think about, like, restorative justice, I have a constituent who, kind of on the other side of the pipeline, he's working with supportive arts therapy for incarcerated people. And through working with there, they are also doing a restorative kind of justice and practice, and it's really making an impact on them. So as I look through the report, I just think of the impact this is having on kids. Like, it's Metro, its programs are Metro, they're suburban, they're greater Minnesota, it's, computer science, culturally infused, programs. Some actually just deal with truancy and the criminal justice system head on. So I just really appreciate, like, the approach, the focus on kids and meeting kids where they are and wherever they are in the state. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. We've had a conversation about the importance on youth intervention programming. I come from leading youth work for several of these organizations and building curriculums for folks and mentorship programs so that those youth take the role as mentorship, and how we can be consistent with that and make sure that these great organizations that are providing those avenues, like my colleague here said, throughout the state, it's not just one area, this is working, have to be uplifted and continue to be amplified of how resourceful they are to contribute to our everyday society, not only for our youth, but those youth change the lives of us as adults as well. They amplify the voices that need to be heard, and sometimes they don't feel heard, and they need to elect more of us to be in these spaces so that we continue to fight for them. Thank you.
Excellent. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Murnier, some of these funds, will this go to, as Representative Nadeau said, the Bridge for Youth and Sister Rita's House?
Mr. Munier.
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of this funding, will that go to some of the organizations, such as the Bridge for Youth and Sister Rita's House? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that when you answer.
Mr. Munier.
Yes, it will, Madam Chair. Yes, it will. It will go to, there's 98 grantees through this program, and they're all across the state. And that money would go to the Bridge for Youth as well.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, well, then I fully support this, and here's why. The Bridge for Youth was founded by my aunts, the McDonald nuns. Aww. My dad had 11 children, 11 children in his family, K.J. McDonald. Six of the sisters, he had six sisters, four were nuns. You know this, Paul. And the Sister Rita, Sister Jane, Sister Kate, and Sister Bridget founded the Bridge for Youth and Sister Rita's House. And they were here last week at the Capitol. I had a God incident. I got to run into them. And they introduced me to the children, the kids, the youth there. And they were thrilled to meet the nun's nephew, favorite nephew, of course. They do great work, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this somehow, the history and the legacy and the beautiful work that that they do with some of this grant money. So just wanted to, I had to include that. Two of the nuns are still alive. They live at the Carondelet Village. Sister Rita died at 100 years old just a couple years ago, and Sister Kate last year. But they did God's mission, God's work, and you are doing the same thing for the youth.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Munier.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, they are one of the original recipients of the YIP grant and have been receiving the money for over four decades.
Wow. All right. Representative Perez-Vega, do you have a very brief comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight that I didn't mention that these programs also provide tech support for those youth in workforce, such as the program that happens with Changes, Inc. in my district, GAP, Guadalupe Area Project. Those students are building houses through housing support from the committee that I sat on last year. And so I just want to give conscious of that it's also providing avenues for our workforce and our youth, and that's so impactful. Mm-hmm. We want our kids to decide whether they want to go straight to college or into those tech jobs, and these development projects are able to accommodate that. So just had to name drop some of the good work that's happening in my district.
Awesome. Well, Representative Feist, I'll give it to you for final comments.
Well, thank you so much. I could say so much. I have so much in my heart. But we're taking my public safety baby and we're bringing it into your care. Well, that's really appropriate because it's Children and Families Committee. Anyway, I didn't mean that metaphor. Anyway, I just am so passionate about this. Paul is so passionate and has been such a great leader. And, you know, these programs are amazing. What the program that I sat in on, when the person who was teaching how to draw had been a participant. So it was just awesome. And I just hope that you will all lift up this important funding. The Youth Restorative Practices Grants supplement this type of funding. I hope it is never an afterthought, but it is really central to when you think about how we can support youth in Minnesota. And I would encourage you to support this funding. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today, Representative Feist. With that, House File 2362 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thanks. Next on our agenda, members, we have House File 2136, Representative Johnson. And first on the list as far as testifiers, we have Mr. Wade Rash. So if you could approach the table as well and get ready to introduce yourself. Representative Johnson, we're happy to have you here in Children and Families. Feel free to kick it off. Actually, no, first I have to move that we're going to re-refer your bill to the Judiciary Committee. No. Oh, my gosh. You're going to public safety. Everybody else is going to Judiciary. All right. I move that House File 2136 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And now you may kick it off.
Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 2136. This bill will provide a total of $500,000 in funding over the next biennium to fund scholarships for forensic interview training. These scholarships will support professionals in law enforcement, child protection, prosecution, health care, and children's advocacy centers.
Members of the audience.
Ensuring they receive the specialized necessary training to conduct accurate, developmentally appropriate, and legally sound forensic interviews. Forensic interviews are critical for child maltreatment investigations. They provide unbiased, fact-based, and culturally responsive conversations that help determine whether abuse has occurred. These interviews allow for a multidisciplinary team from child protection to criminal justice to make informed decisions that impact the safety and well-being of the child. A well-conducted forensic interview not only strengthens investigations and prosecutions, but also ensures that the children receive the support that they need. This funding will ensure forensic interviewers from across Minnesota receive basic forensic interview training, advanced training, or other specialized training on these interview topics, helping to prevent the re-traumatization and reducing the need for redundant interviews. The more skilled and well-trained our forensic interviews are, the more effectively they can support children's safety, justice, and healing. Thank you. I do have three testifiers, Mr. Rausch, as well as Katie Hone, and then Marsha Milliken, if we have time.
All right. Mr. Rausch, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wade Rausch, St. Louis County Sheriff's Office. I'm a division commander in Duluth. I do have years of experience working with investigations involving child sex and abuse. I'm here in obviously in support of the bill, as is Sheriff Ramsey. More largely, I'd like to offer the support from the broader law enforcement community in Minnesota. Oftentimes, cops are really bad at it. We start talking about this work and assume that everybody knows the stuff that we're talking about. As it pertains to this, MDT, multidisciplinary team, forensic interview, disclosure. So just briefly, I'd like to expand on that. My dad peed on me with his skin butt. That's an example of a disclosure that occurred in one of the cases I investigated several years ago. Kindergartner tells her teacher, my dad peed on me with his skin butt. We can all agree that that's an inflammatory, very concerning statement. What we can agree on is what it means. That's the linchpin, then, of this investigation is the forensic interview. What we don't want is a cop, is a social worker, is multiple cops, multiple social workers going and talking to the kid, trying to determine what they mean. We're going to encapsulate that in one research-based, legally sound, non-biased interview that's taking into consideration the age, demographic, cultural appropriateness of the child. So then you get the truth. That's what the forensic interview obtains, and that goes to the MDT, the multidisciplinary team then, which is made of professionals across the spectrum to include law enforcement and prosecution, but so the social workers assigned to the case, and then mental and physical health workers, advocacy, everybody involved to try to bring justice to the child. And oftentimes that is going to mean a follow-up as far as holding the offender accountable. So what we feel, what I certainly support, is that when this disclosure occurs, as it will today, as it does throughout the state on a daily basis, the response is not the same. There will be forensic interviews conducted by law enforcement, by professional forensic interviewers, by social workers. We hope that these scholarships will provide the broader MDT team to be trained, the broader multidisciplinary team, to be trained in the forensic interview so that the response is consistent and in the best possible outcome for the potentially abused child. I realize I'm over. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rausch. We have Carrie Hone joining us remotely today. If you are able to take yourself off mute and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here remotely today as well. Good afternoon, and I thank the members of the House Children and Families Finance Committee for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2136. I'm a program manager in child protection in Olmsted County, and I have supervisory responsibilities for the social workers who carry out child protection assessments and investigations. County and tribal social service agencies are tasked with responding to reports of child maltreatment involving allegations of neglect, physical and sexual abuse. An initial part of this response involves meeting with a child or children who have experienced abuse to gather information regarding this experience. The utilization of forensic interviewing in the initial work with a child ensures that this process is done in a way that's developmentally appropriate. Social workers, as well as other folks in the MDT, receive training to conduct forensic interviews in a way that minimizes any further harm that can be experienced by a child when they're disclosing details of their abuse. The forensic process follows a protocol that allows for details to be gathered in a way that puts the child at the center of the investigative process. The protocol is legally sound, culturally responsive, unbiased, and fact-based. Crucial information is gathered to plan for safety of the child or children. It helps inform subsequent service planning to attend to both the physical and mental health of the child. Olmsted County, along with other counties in the state of Minnesota, rely upon scholarships to fund attendance in the basic, advanced, and ongoing forensic interviewer training provided through Corner House or First Witness. This funding ensures that child protection staff across the state of Minnesota receive the training necessary to carry out forensic interviews with children that's timely and responsive to their needs. Without continued funding, Olmsted County, along with other counties, will struggle to ensure that staff receiving the training need to complete forensic interviews. Olmsted County, along with MAXA, appreciate your support of the children and your work to ensure their safety and well-being. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hone, for joining us. Representative Johnson, you said that you had a third testifier. I'm not sure if I know that person's name.
Marcia Milliken is the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance.
Very good. You can approach the table. You've got 2 minutes. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Marcia Milliken. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance, which is a coalition of children's advocacy centers and multidisciplinary teams dedicated to protecting and advocating for child abuse victims and their non-offending caregivers. Forensic interviews are life-saving. They give traumatized children a voice while ensuring their statements are gathered in a legally sound, emotionally safe manner. Before forensic interview protocols existed, children often had to relive their trauma 10 to 15 times, retelling their story to various professionals, each time reliving their trauma. Today, we have 11 nationally recognized forensic interview protocols, including two leading programs in Minnesota, First Witness and Corner House. Conducting these interviews requires extensive training, and access to that training is at risk. Forensic interview scholarships have relied on federal funding through the Children's Justice Act Task Force, but with increasing demands on those funds, we must act now to ensure continued investment in child protection. House File 2136 will fund scholarships for both basic and advanced forensic interview training, ensuring legally sound, developmentally appropriate interviews, reduce trauma for children by minimizing unnecessary repetitive interviews, stronger child protection and criminal investigations, and empowered professionals equipped to safeguard children. Without proper training, child abuse interviews can be ineffective or even harmful, leading to lost evidence, failed prosecutions, and unprotected children. We can't let this happen. House File 2136 is an investment in justice, safety, and the future of Minnesota's children. I strongly urge your support for House File 2136. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Milliken. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 2136 today? All right, with that, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for bringing this bill, and hello to my Olmsted County peeps. I hear we're in a blizzard down there, but I don't know if that's actually true. So thank you for joining us remotely. I just wanted to share how important I think this funding is and these types of evaluations are. As many people in this community or in this committee know, my husband and I have done foster care, including emergency placement. And so I have been the home that folks, that kiddos come to right after going through their interview. And I understand the importance of making sure that we do not create a system and a situation that is more traumatizing when we're already trauma. So this is an investment in our youth, it's an investment in our future, and it's investment in the long-term success of these kids and these families. So thank you so much for this. Really appreciate the support in this space.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I did hear, I think there's 11 interview protocol organizations, two in Minnesota. My question is, I've got just two or three short ones. Is this a train-the-trainer scholarship program, or is this literally, there's three different modules in here and people can pick and choose, or is all this one training thing? So there's basic forensic interview, there's advanced forensic interview, training on specialized interview. Is that those three separate modules that each one person would be eligible for? How does this work?
So, Ms. Milliken.
So the 11 protocol trainings are in the nation. So they're throughout the country. Anybody can attend those. We have two right here in Minnesota, First Witness and Corner House. The forensic interview training is 32 hours, a minimum of 32 hours long. It lasts for 4 to 5 days, depending on the model. All the protocol models are similar, and it's usually up to the individual department or individual interviewer as to which one they want to attend. There are sections on child development, how to ask questions in the forensic interview. There are practice modules so that they're able to get feedback on their interview skills. And that's just basic training. Then there's advanced forensic interview training, which is for people who have been doing these interviews for a while, and they're able to come back and get feedback on their interviews and also talk about different case scenarios. And then the third level are advanced interview topics, which can be very specialized. It can be on how to interview nonverbal children, or how to use more than one session with a very young child. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. And that does that. No, that's very helpful. What is the average scholarship cost? How many people will this $500,000 serve?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding is the classes cost right around $1,300 for each one of these. So divide that out, and ideally that's as many as we can fill them up. So,
and last
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. Currently, I'm assuming there's a number of people in Minnesota that have gone through this training. Mm-hmm. Either the county is paying for them through property taxes or whatever. Are there my last thing is. I know that there's a number of foundations that really focus on training, and especially in this area. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Annie E. Casey Foundation. Have any of, to your knowledge, Chief?
Commander.
Commander, you. I'm sorry. To your knowledge, have any foundations stepped up to help leverage some of these dollars so that we could meet more needs across the state?
Commander Rash.
To my knowledge, no. Specific to different agencies, like for instance, my agency would continue to fund forensic interview training for our investigators, regardless of where the money was coming from, as a necessity for the work we're doing. But not every organization or municipality or county social would have that same attitude or capability.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have Representative Zalesnikar on the list, and then members. I am going to give it back to Representative Johnson for final comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this bill. After listening to the horrific situations we listened to the last time we were at Children and Family, I can't help but think this would be a helpful process for children. And I was curious, in the information, it was talking about the types of people that could be in the classes, various backgrounds. I'm just wondering, do you get more applicants from a certain sector typically throughout the state?
Ms. Milliken.
Thank you. There are typically the most applicants are either in law enforcement, child protection, or prosecution. There are other professions that go through the training, but primarily that is the bulk of who receives forensic interview training, because they are an integral part of the multidisciplinary team.
Representative Zalesnikar, any follow-up? Okay. Representative Johnson, go ahead with your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair, and the rest of the committee. This bill is about ensuring the most vulnerable children in our state receive the protection and justice that they deserve. Forensic interviews like these are critical in the step of identifying abuse, supporting investigations, and ensuring children receive the necessary services for healing. Without properly trained forensic interviewers, we risk getting it wrong. By funding these scholarships for this type of training, we are equipping professionals with the skills needed to conduct these sensitive interviews in the way they need to be done. I urge your support on 2136 and prioritize getting these kids the help that they need. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for bringing the bill. And with that, members, I renew my motion that House File 2136 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. And Representative Johnson, you are on your way across the hall. Guess what? We have to take a vote. Guys, I haven't done this in a while. All right, so it's true. Oh, my gosh. Guys, I'm falling apart. And Chair West isn't even here. He's testifying in another committee. He's not refusing to participate in committee because I have the gavel today. But I know he was upset that I did not bring candy. So I apologize. I will do better. So we do have to take a vote. Members, all in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. With that, Representative Johnson, you are on your way to public safety. Thank you. We have House File 1316 from Representative Curran and our testifiers, Trish Scopehammer, to prepare to. I'm going to move that House File 1316 is re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I got it right this time. All right, Representative Curran, take it away.
Thank you, Chair and members. First, I'd like to offer an author's amendment, if we could.
Good. Okay. We have the A1. I will move the A1 before the committee. Representative Curran, to the amendment.
Thank you, Chair. The A1 is essentially a technical amendment and also changes the effective date to July 1st, 2026.
All right. Members, any discussion on the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Very good. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Curran, to your bill as amended.
Thank you again, Chair and committee members. House File 1316 is a bill that would require employers in the state of Minnesota to report new hires of 1099 independent contractors to DCYF. There's been a substantial rise over the past decade in non-traditional employees, and that includes 1099 independent contractors working for various companies. This new stream of income has made it more difficult to collect court-ordered child support under current law, even when the paying parent is working. By requiring reporting of 1099 independent contractors, this proposal would increase payments and enhance the fairness of child support orders. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, Trish Scopehammer, the child support director at Ramsey County.
All right. Ms. Scopehammer, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Trish Scopehammer. I am the Director of Child Support Services in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I've been working in the field of child support for about 28 years, so I've seen a lot of trends over those years. Currently, all employers are required to report to a new hire database whenever they hire somebody. And then that database is compared to child support records to determine whether or not the person who's been hired has a child support obligation. And that helps us collect child support. The vast majority of the child support that we collect comes through income withholding, which I'm sure many of you are aware of. Income withholding is automatically done by statute. So it's not just for delinquent payers of child support. It's for everybody. But there is no requirement for reporting independent contractors. And back in the day when I first started working in child support, that usually meant people who were painting houses or laying carpet. But there's a whole new industry of people who are working as 1099 employees doing gig work like DoorDash driving, Uber driving, Lyft driving, things like that. And there's evidence that tells us that people who owe child support obligations tend to participate in that gig industry more often than the general population. And we don't know where people are working. Therefore, we can't get income withholding in place unless they tell us that they're working somewhere, and there are people who don't want to tell us that because they prefer not to pay their child support. Most people do pay, but there are some that try to avoid paying child support. So this would improve child support collections. There are 20 states that already do this as a requirement. There's some interest in making it a federal regulation as well, but at this time it's not a federal regulation, so states are doing it state by state, and Minnesota would like to join the other states who have this provision.
Thank you, Ms. Scopehammer. Any members of the public who wish to testify on House File 1316? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Members, Representative Sensumura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this bill. This makes a lot of sense. I know that we've done a lot of work in the legislature in the last few years just about how do we monitor, catch up with, align with the gig economy. You know, it feels, I think generally I'll just say it feels like we're always two steps behind the gig economy. And so I know that as our work changes, we need to make a lot of changes to how we are reporting or thinking through different things. I think I have a question about how this kind of works practically and in terms of the employers. So it sounds like we are maybe building a system that doesn't exist, but can you talk through under the bill, if I'm an employer that has, you know, many 1099 employees, it looks like I'm sending a copy of that to the department around tax time. Can you just talk a little bit through how it actually plays out? Thank you.
Ms. Scopehammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there is already a system in place for reporting new workers who are not 1099 employees or 1099 contractors but new employees. So it would use that same system. There's a website, I guess, or a portal that the employers would go to, and they enter that information into that system when they do the new hire. That system is maintained by our partners at DCYF, and so they would work with the contractors that help create that interface and that reporting system to bring it up to speed for including independent contractors. And that's one of the reasons why we changed the effective date, is to allow more time for those things to be put into place.
Representative Sensumura.
Thank you. And follow up, can you talk through a little bit about how employers are going to be notified of this, how people can make sure that they're in compliance? Thank you.
Ms. Scopehammer.
Thank you. There will be some active efforts by our partners at DCYF to inform and educate employers on this requirement. I won't personally be involved in those details, so I can't speak too much on that, but I know that that effort will be done at the state level.
Any follow-up? All right. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struggling with this one. So give me I'm going to throw a situation. How would you deal with this? In a construction contract that goes through a municipality, Ramsey County, they're going to build a bunch of roads. They go through and they use the CERT-certified program where we get minority, we have women goals, we have people performing, and some of those smaller contractors that were working really hard to get there, they're employees of that company, but they may be independent contractors of that sub. How would a small contractor, they're already dealing with affirmative action, they're already dealing with prevailing wage, they're already dealing with all these things, how would this affect those small contractors? That's my question one. And in the same contract, there's truckers, lots of them, and they're all independents. There's thousands of them. And they don't get, half the time, they're not even acknowledged. They're not even brought into the paperwork of these large projects until months after the project is done, as it's closing. So how would, this seems problematic for small contractors, small minority and women-owned businesses, and independent truckers. And those are just off the top of my head. So tell me how this would, how would this would apply to them, please?
Ms. Scopehammer.
Thank you. I think that some of the people that you're mentioning, the truck drivers and some of the subcontractors for construction companies, are the most difficult to collect child support from if they're not voluntarily choosing to pay their child support. So it really is an issue in that sort of sector of people who are working. But in terms of the impact on them, I would say that if they are already employers, so you may subcontract with people who do the actual work, but you may also employ people as regular employees who do your accounting and your your payroll and things like that. So they may have some way that they're already doing the new hire reporting, so it may not be a new requirement for them in terms of understanding the system, but it may be new in terms of the people, the number of people that they have to report. And so there would be a burden. That's absolutely true, that there would be an additional burden on employers, and we rely heavily on employers in the child support program to make sure that we are collecting child support. And so this would, it would make a difference for sure, but it would also make a very big difference in child support collections.
Representative Doe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talk about the difference then. I mean, if we're going to make employers do a lot of work where the state can't make someone comply, then we're going to force now employers to force them to comply. I mean, talk to me about, we're going a long way. Don't get me wrong, I'm all about making sure that people pay their child support. I'm not trying to get people off the hook. I'm just trying to find that balance between if the state can't compel, why should we force employers to compel?
Ms. Scopammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm understanding your question, if the state can't compel people to pay child support, the state can, and counties in Minnesota are the boots on the ground in terms of compelling people to pay child support. There's lots of tools that we use to try to get people to pay, and there are people that slip through the cracks for sure. In terms of making sure that employers or payers of independent contractors comply, there may be some tools I'm not quite familiar with. We're starting to look into that we might use, but we generally are not big on the compliance end with employers making sure that they do new hire reporting anyway. I think most comply because they know that they're supposed to. They know that it's the law, and so that gives us then the information that we need.
Thank you.
Members, any further discussion? Representative West?
Chair West?
You're amazing, Vice Chair Hansen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Also, she brought candy today.
She's pulling her weight. I have just one really basic question, which actually I don't really like when representatives ask it, but I do want to know. Did you consult with, like, Chamber or any of the business organizations that would be concerned about a mandate like this?
Representative Curran or Ms. Schopammer?
Speaking from my perspective as the bill author, I haven't had those conversations. This has been language that was introduced last biennium as well I believe it was Representative Scott who initially dropped this bill. I'm not sure what those conversations entailed, but the language has been out there. I have not heard a peep on whether or not those organizations have any heartburn over this.
Chair West?
Thank you, Representative Curran. I'm not trying to trap you in any way. This committee, we actually ask real questions in good faith. It's kind of weird, isn't it? I haven't heard a peep either. So you're good there, but it's always whenever you have something that affects people, good to consult whatever organization represents them. The other question I have might be for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Is just wondering, is there another, so requiring employers to report all hires, that's a lot of reporting, just raw numbers. Is there anything that the department already does where they receive reports from something like every single employer with a 1099?
Ms. Scopammer, are you able to answer that question? I'm not sure. I think there might be someone from DCF in the audience, DCYF in the audience, but otherwise we could potentially follow up offline if needed. Would Sarah Florman know? All right. Very good. Okay. Someone's on their way. You can introduce yourself for the record and answer the question for us if you're able.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Fraley. I'm the legislative lead in the Child Support Division. And if you could just repeat the question one more time.
Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming up. The question was, this is a bill that requires a lot of reporting from many entities to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Is there another system? Is the department familiar with receiving a large volume of reports like this? Because this seems like a lot. And that's just, is there another thing you'd consider comparable that the department receives reports on?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative West, the department receives, I could look up the exact number, but it's thousands of reports every month for new hire reports. Independent contractors right now can be reported as optional, and the department does get new hire reports right now from independent contractors. So this would increase the volume of those reports, but we do get a lot of those reports already right now.
Chair West?
Thank you. That's a superb answer to the question. Nobody likes deadbeat dads getting away with not paying their child support. So if this goes to helping that get resolved, the other question that I don't need answered immediately, but if there's something after the fact, is I might have been brought up before I came in for my bill hearing, how much unpaid child support is out there in Minnesota. I don't know, but I'm sure I'll be depressed by the number. But thanks for bringing forward the bill, Representative Curran.
All right. Seeing no other discussion members, I'll move to Representative Curran for closing comments.
Thank you so much again, chairs and committee members. Again, we have a real issue where folks are receiving income and it's not being reported or counted as income that they have. At a really basic level, I think both to Rep. Nitto's point and to Rep. Sensenmura's point, we've done a lot of work in this state to legitimize a lot of the gig economy. There was a ton done last biennium to, for example, legitimize the work in transportation services, right? And I think, you know, when we do that work and we honor and say, yep, some people are getting their full-time income on these gig economy jobs, the other side of the coin is that there's some responsibility that comes with earning money. And part of that is when you're subject to, like, child support, for example, you've got to pay it. And so if you have income, that needs to be known, and that child support then needs to be collected. And I will say, as somebody who worked in HR for 5 years before coming to the legislature, I've been the person to enter new hires from an employer. It's super, super simple. It's it's a website you go to. There's a variety of things that you're doing when you're doing new hire paperwork and processing as somebody in HR. This is one of the simplest processes in that overall new hire process, quite literally. Website, double-click the link, put in their name, info, hire date, submit, you're done. And then when the report then is received, likely they're getting just a mass report of people who were hired where and when. I think this is, well, seemingly complicated, it's actually a relatively simple task that we're asking for, but the result is huge and impactful for families. So I thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Curran. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1316 be re-referred to the committee on, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
All right. The motion passes, and you are on your way to Judiciary. Thank you, Representative Curran. Great. The next item on our list for the day is Vice Chair Hansen's House File.
Get ready.
Oh. You know what? We actually have another visiting member to the committee, so we're going to let Representative Kraft go next, House File 1614. Representative Kraft, you can come up to the table with your testifiers, and I will move that House File 1614 also be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And I also see that you have an author's DE1 amendment. Can you explain the amendment? Do you want to take care of that first?
Sure.
All right, go ahead.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and good to be at this committee. So the amendment tightens the language a bit and also moves the from 260C in law to 260E, which is a more appropriate location. It's kind of like being at the front door instead of the middle door is how it's described to me, but it's trying to do the same thing. And it gets the bill in the form I would like it.
Right. Members, any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Representative Nitto.
And why is this, thank you, why is this being put in 260? Why is this put in this statute?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Abderholden, maybe I might ask you this one.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Ndo, so this was currently a policy, which kind of goes to our testimony. It was a policy for the department that frankly wasn't always being followed, and so we wanted to move into statute. Originally, we thought it should go into 260C, but after discussing with the department, it made more sense to do it for 260E because those are the reporters.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And could you please introduce yourself for the record?
I'm sorry.
Not a problem.
Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Members, any further discussion on the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the member would like? Oh, Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this amendment. I think it improves the bill, gives a little more clarity on compared to what it was. So I think this is a good amendment. Thanks for working on it.
Great. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Right. The DE1 is adopted, and Representative Kraft, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So this is one of those things that when it was brought to me, I kind of said, really, this happens? Can't really happen, can it? And it does. And so the bill puts into statute a policy adopted by DHS in 2023 to not screen into child protection families who cannot safely bring their child that has a serious mental illness that cannot bring them home due to lack of services. Despite the policy being in place since 2023, NAMI, Minnesota, and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities continue to hear from families who are being referred to child protection. These are families who are engaged with and love their child, but their child's needs are very complex. Several of them have even been adopted out of child protection system and thus have experienced severe trauma. They've often placed their children on waiting lists for residential treatment, applied for community access for disability inclusion or CADI waivers, and much more. But the wait lists are long, and it's very hard to find people to work with your child when they have extreme or aggressive symptoms. Also, just because a family is referred to child protection doesn't mean that services are going to become available, as I think we know. They won't, because they don't exist nearly enough. But referring these families to child protection can put them at risk of losing their jobs and custody of their own children. What's happening seems to me to be akin to blaming families and makes their lives harder. We need to support them and help them. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers.
Great. Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and we really strongly support this bill. I have personally taken calls from numerous parents who have been placed in this situation. They have a child with complex needs, often symptoms that are aggressive, a child who is homicidal or suicidal. Their needs simply cannot be met at home. They cannot keep their child or other family members safe. We are not talking about simple depression or a suicide attempt. We are talking about children who are so dysregulated or with histories of extreme trauma that they are lashing out, throwing objects, trying to physically hurt the parents or other siblings. They're brought to the ER, and if they're lucky, they're admitted. And then when the hospital wants to discharge them and the family doesn't believe they can keep them or their other family members safe and they refuse to take the child home, they are threatened with being reported to child protection, despite the fact that they may have placed their child on every wait list that exists for intensive services or residential treatment, despite them desperately calling every agency they can find to ask for help. I want to make it very clear that we are talking about highly engaged parents. They are not neglecting their child. The system is. We simply do not have enough services and supports for these children. They have not abandoned their children. They are desperately seeking services for them. They love them, and they are fighting for them, but there is so little out there to help them. Their stories have left me in tears and, frankly, angry at the system. Not only do the hospitals not need to threaten and then report these parents to child protection, but clearly under the current screening policy, counties do not need to screen them into child protection. We have heard hospitals say that counties tell them that the only way to get services is through the child protection door. And yet these children have a children's mental health case manager and things like that. For over 20 years, NAMI has worked to separate out children's mental health from child protection. and yet here we are. To make it clear, child protection does not have a magic wand. They cannot make these services magically appear. By putting these families in child protection, you're threatening their jobs and their ability to keep their families together. Families have been told that their other children will be taken away. If they work with children in another setting, they risk losing their job. I understand that hospitals are frustrated by having these children in the ER or in a bed, but referring these families to child protection simply does not solve the problem. Because the screening guidelines are being ignored, NAMI adamantly believes that we need to put this language into statute. I urge you to support this bill. Let's not make it any harder for these families. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Next we have RG Manolis. If you could.
She would be online if she's able to be there.
Okay, all right. We also have Michelle Wood, who is joining us virtually. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Wood. I live in rural Goodhue County with my husband of nearly 22 years and the four of our five children who have not yet graduated. I'm speaking to you today about my funny cat, duck, and 4-H loving daughter whose smile can light up a room. She came to our home the week of her first birthday, is known for her giant dimples, and has struggled with feelings of depression, suicidal ideation, and self-harm for years. She was in kindergarten the first time we carried her out of a store screaming that she wanted to kill herself. She has diagnoses of ADHD, impulse control difficulties, depression, learning disabilities, and reactive attachment disorder. 2024 was a tough year with multiple psychiatric hospitalizations, as well as a 10-day stay at the Southeastern Minnesota Regional Crisis Center, or CIRC. That was after assaulting me and one of her sisters, an incident that scared her. After her time at CIRC, she started a new medication. We changed therapist to one who did animal-assisted therapy and EMDR, and we began to see progress. Then on December 8th, my husband David was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and the bottom fell out of our world. On one of the coldest days in January, my daughter ran out of the house with no coat and no shoes. My 11-year-old son followed his safety plan and locked himself in his room while her sisters and I ran after her. They caught up with her first, putting themselves between her and the road. She then started assaulting them, even grabbing one of her sisters by the throat and choking her. I caught up with them just as this happened and managed to pull her away. She then ran into our field, where she lay unresponsive for nearly an hour on the frozen ground until the sheriff's deputies finally convinced her to go in the house. She was taken by ambulance to the hospital and then again to CIRC. While at CIRC, she had inappropriate and assaultive behaviors and was taken by ambulance to the hospital and then transferred to an inpatient adolescent psych unit. We worked with our children's mental health case manager and our insurance company to get her approved for residential care at Girard in Austin, but it would be a few weeks before she could be admitted. Then the hospital called and said we needed to take her home, despite the fact that she was still saying she was afraid she would hurt others. We begged doctors, nurses, and the hospital social worker to help us find a safe place for her to go until she could be admitted to Girard. Our county social worker applied to a shelter in the cities, but there wasn't a bed. Our health plan advocate spent hours on the phone with us, trying to find other options, even a bed at another hospital, all to no avail. Over the next several days, we fielded multiple phone calls from doctors threatening to report us to child protection. I had called NAMI, so I had the screening document saying I shouldn't be screened in, but I knew that wasn't a guarantee. On Monday night, CIRC refused to admit her again because she had endorsed homicidal ideations during their interview. On Tuesday morning, I was sitting with my husband during chemotherapy. Rather than spending precious time with him, I was frantically speaking with our social worker and health plan advocate, still trying to come up with a plan for her. That's also when I received the call from the psychiatrist telling me they were making that child protection report. We told her that we would be over once we finished in the chemo clinic, and we brought our daughter home that day, against our better judgment, but at least we'd gotten through chemo. We have faithfully cared for our daughter's special needs for years, but this time we knew she needed more than we alone could provide. Shockingly, even with all the begging for help we did, the only discharge advice from the hospital was, if she gets aggressive and hurts someone, call 911 and press charges. And on last Monday, 21 hours before she was admitted to Girard, that is exactly what happened after she assaulted her best friend at school. My daughter deserves better care than let the justice system deal with her. The rest of my family deserves to feel safe. We've put key locks on all the bedroom doors. We have added motion cameras to record the interior and exterior of our home. We've added driveway alarms. We clearly are not neglecting our daughter. We've tried desperately to get her the treatment she needs. Our choices were to be charged with neglect and fight that battle while fighting cancer, or risk the safety of an entire family. And all of you here today have the power to change that for the next family, and I beg you to do so. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Wood, for sharing your experience and for all that you are doing to keep your children safe. Next on the list, we have Lisa Anthony Thomas. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Anthony Thomas, and I'm the Deputy Ombudsman for the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Our office has a statutory charge to promote the highest attainable standards of treatment, competence, efficiency, and justice for our clients receiving services for mental health, developmental disabilities, and substance use disorder. For many years, our office has heard the heartbreaking experiences of parents desperately seeking medically necessary care for their children, but unable to access the right level of care and services due to limited capacity throughout Minnesota's children's mental health services continuum. I'm here today to express strong support for House File 1614 that codifies the changes that were made to the maltreatment screening guidelines in 2023 to explicitly state that when parents are actively involved in seeking care, but care is not currently available, that is not neglect. These are children with complex support needs, including aggressive behaviors and intense suicidality, requiring sufficient services and supports to ensure theirs and others' safety. Unfortunately, for too many of these children and families, there are not providers currently willing and with the capacity to serve them. In some cases, as we all know, they end up boarding in emergency rooms and hospitals. Many of these children already have children's mental health and waiver case managers who are actively working alongside the parents on finding a placement option or service provider that can meet the children's needs, only to receive denial after denial from providers because the child's needs are too acute. Or these children have been discharged from another current residential care setting because the provider could not meet their needs amid safety concerns, even with 24/7 staffing. And when a provider is identified, there may be weeks or months waiting on a wait list. These are all circumstances beyond a parent's control. It's certainly not neglect. Despite the updated screening guidelines, we continue to hear from families that are threatened into
recording in progress
an unsafe discharge plan with no services or supports, or they risk a report to child protection. We hear from parents with active child protection investigations and involvement because they advocated for their child's safety and care needs and refused an unsafe discharge plan. Parents report feeling unnecessarily blamed and shamed by a process they have no control over. These parents do not represent caregivers who are unwilling or unable to provide care. And when our staff do get involved advocating for the child and families, identifying that the screening guidelines were updated to specifically exclude these exact situations, we hear from counties and hospitals that they do not consider the guidelines binding, as they are simply guidelines. House File 1614 will change that by clarifying in statute that lack of sufficient capacity for children to have timely access to medically necessary care may be a systemic failure, but it is not a parental one. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Anthony Thomas. We do have Argy Manolis joining us virtually now. If you could unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony. All right, we're having some technical difficulties. We will sort
Hello.
That.
Oh. I cannot hear what is happening in the room. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Oh, the room audio is muted. Ah. All right. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you, Robert, for hearing. My name is Argy Manolis. Since 2008, I have adopted 5 children out of foster care. 1 is a single parent and 4 with my spouse. My spouse and I are also legal guardians of our grandson. Since 2014, we've cared for about 15 people, many of whom still rely on us for support. This is our calling and the greatest honor of our lives. I'm here today to talk about our son. He came into our lives at age 7 as an emergency foster care placement in the middle of the night. Once he settled into our home, he was curious about the world and eager to learn new things. He loves to explore the outdoors and always wants to help others. We supported reunification until this was no longer an option. We were honored that both his family and his tribe agreed for us to become his adoptive parents. His adoption day when he was 10 was one of the happiest days of my life. We loved him more than I could ever put into words. As we advocated for our son and established cultural, mental health, educational, and other supports for him, we learned that in addition to his complex trauma, he had a rare genetic disorder that would affect his physical health and cognitive, social, and mental health functioning for the rest of his life. Unfortunately, one of the symptoms of his disability is sudden violent outbursts. Despite a great effort and a great support team and every possible intervention, and believe me, we've traveled all over the state and tried many different options, we were unable to stop these from happening. To make a long story short, there have been dozens of visits to a school and to our home by police officers after many assaults and property damage, followed by a trip to our local rural ER. The ER would always quickly discharge him. Eventually, we began waiting until he was calm after an incident and driving him to an ER in the Twin Cities, 3 hours from our home. There, he was more likely to receive the mental health services he needed. After 1 or 2 weeks in the ER, he would be transferred to a mental health facility for another 2 to 3 weeks, then return home. And this pattern happened over and over again until mental health facilities began to refuse to take him. In 2022, we made the most difficult decision of our lives. When an ER in the Twin Cities could not place him and discharged him, we refused to take him home. What followed was a daily call to our local CPS for nearly 2 months. We were terrified. Both of us could have lost our jobs, and my spouse could have lost her nursing license. We were most worried about who would care for our children if they were taken from us after finally finding a loving forever home. Our local CPS understood the situation and never opened a case against us, but as the weeks wore on, it was difficult to trust that there would ever be an end to a stay in the hospital. After about 2 months, he was admitted to a new facility that serves kids with complex diagnoses. He was their second admit. It was a miracle. The facility had everything he needed and supported our whole family's healing. But after 14 months, insurance refused to continue to pay for his stay, and he returned home. From September 23 to September 24, I took a partial leave of absence from work to care for him. By this time, 5 different in-home care companies had refused to serve him, even though he had 40 hours of care available through his waiver, 40 hours a week. One Saturday morning, our son assaulted me after I stepped in between him and our 5-year-old grandson. As usual, the police transported him to the local ER, which would not hold him. This time, the police charged him and took him to a juvenile detention center 2 hours from our home, explaining it was the only way they could think to keep our family safe. After 60 days, he received a Rule 20, and the judge ordered us to pick him up. For the second time, we refused. This time, the judge ruled that a CPS case should be opened against us. Although CPS did not want to start a case, the judge had ordered them to do so. Again, we faced all the same fears, job loss, and of course, most importantly, the loss of our children. Our CPS case has been closed because we reluctantly signed a voluntary placement agreement with the juvenile detention center. We didn't feel we had any other choice. Our son is now 15. He has been waiting for placement there since mid-September. We visit at least once a week and talk to him daily, as we have every time he has been away from us. All of our visits and calls end with, "I miss you and I love you." We're lucky to have 2 very dedicated case managers, one who supports his mental health needs and one who supports his developmental disability. So far between them, they have contacted 102 different options for placement, all of which have turned them down. These include home care companies, group homes, residential treatment centers, and many other types of facilities. In short, Mental health care in our state is made up of very dedicated people who could not be working harder. But especially for kids in rural areas and kids with complex needs, there's not adequate help. Even privileged, experienced parents like us could not find help for our son, and we don't know how other parents with fewer resources and supports are faring. When a parent refuses to pick a child up from the ER or juvenile detention center, believe me, we are experiencing the most excruciating decision of our lives. We are not parents neglecting our children. We are parents desperately trying to help ourselves and our other children remain safe, and perhaps most importantly, desperately trying to get help for our child. Help that has never been available in the 8 years we have cared for and loved him. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Ms. Manolis, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And thank you for doing all that you are to keep your family safe. Finally, for testifiers, we have Angie Tice. You can approach the table, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your brief testimony.
Are we okay? Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Katiza Watun and Chair West, for the opportunity to testify today on House File 1614. For the record, my name is Angela Tice, and I serve as the Child Wellbeing Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I offer testimony today on behalf of MACSA, which is the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, which is an association comprised of human service leaders from over 87 counties and is an affiliate of AMC. I'm here today because our members are concerned with the proposed language and worry that the language as currently drafted may hinder a county's ability to respond when a child protection response is warranted. And it may also create barriers to accessing voluntary county services that children and families may desire. We do appreciate and are supportive of the amendment offered. It's no surprise that child protection is a serious and deep end systems response. Whenever possible, counties do prioritize community-based resources and voluntary services, aiming to offer support before situations escalate to assist families to get the support they need to thrive without initiating a child protection response. We agree with Sue and NAMI and others that the need really is for additional services and supports in this area. We recognize that families are best served with community-based supports and services and utilize placement as a last resort, while understanding placement is sometimes necessary to achieve safety and well-being. Staying at a hospital or a county office is not ideal for children at any circumstance, but sometimes is the only option to give the underdeveloped and under-resourced system of children's mental health care. Minnesota, like many other states, is facing a critical need to address access to services, supports, and placements to limit the need to board children in hospitals, county offices, and other settings. Addressing this issue will involve dedicated resources toward the entire continuum of care, from prevention to placement, while also ensuring we have the workforce needed to implement the staff and services and supports. On behalf of MACSA, we'd like to stress that the screening guidelines are best positioned to guide this work. These guidelines can be updated as needed depending on the dynamic nature of this work, federal and state policy changes, and the changing climate and regulation within Minnesota, in partnership with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and other partners. In November, as many of the testifiers have stated.
Sorry, Ms. Tice.
Thank you. In closing, we'd like to offer support again for the amendment language as it's been offered and urge the legislature to make the necessary and much needed investments in the areas of children's mental health, including developing a service array that both supports preventive and crisis-oriented care, including developing placements that support a youth at the level of care needed. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill and pledge to continue working with Representative Kraft, NAMI, the Hospital Association, and DCY if further adjustments are needed. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? No. All right. Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. First on the list, we have Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Representative Kraft, for this legislation. I'm a co-author. And I'm also carrying several children's mental health bills in an attempt to try to fix the larger problem. But I just want to be really clear. I've been in this space advocating with families since before I was in the legislature, going back 20 years. I have sat in emergency rooms and had these conversations with families and doctors trying to advocate to not put people in danger. I have sat with parents as they signed the forms, like one of our testifiers did, for involuntary termination or voluntary termination of their rights to place their children in places that they had no desire to ever send them. I have watched us have this conversation for 20 years. I was here when we put in guidelines, and I continue to hear from families on a regular basis in my district and throughout this state who are not feeling like those guidelines are working. There are children in our state who have sat in hospitals for a year. There are children in our state who are sitting, like our testifier shared, in juvenile justice facilities with a developmental disability and a severe and persistent mental health crisis, receiving no mental health services and receiving no supports for their developmental disability, but instead being held in kitty jail because we do not have the services. And in addition to the disgusting component that is, that we are sending 86 children in 2023 alone out of state to receive treatment on taxpayer county dimes because we don't have the facilities, like as awful as all of that is, this part is that we're also looking at moms and dads who are doing absolutely everything they can, and we're saying, well, I'm sorry, we can't help you, but that's a you problem because you're the parent. Sorry. It is unconscionable, and it keeps happening. And it is time for us as a legislature to stand up and say, parents who are doing everything they can should not be punished for our failures to create a system that meets the needs of children. Anything else is a travesty that must stop in this state. I am so tired of taking those calls, Sue. I'm so tired of taking those calls. I am so tired of listening to families who say, I have a case manager. I have a certification of disability. I have a waiver. I have all the things, and no one will work with my child because they insert XYZ behavior. It is enough. And if we cannot create a system that's going to make those needs and meet those needs, and I believe we can, but in the meantime, could we maybe not blame, shame, parents and take away their ability to work as nurses and doctors and many of them social workers themselves for something that we have created and we refuse to use our political capital to fix?
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Nadeau.
I couldn't agree more, Representative Hicks. And thank you for bringing this, and we're going to have an opportunity to try to fix it coming up or at least work towards it. And I support this bill, and I thank you for bringing it. I'll be carrying a county-connected youth bill that is going to start trying to provide those proper placements, and it's going to be expensive. And, you know, by voting on this, it could possibly board children in hospitals longer. But they're going to have a parent, and it's going to have a cost. And these are costs that none of us should have to pay, and parents shouldn't have to bear. But we have ignored this, and the agencies have ignored this for too long. And so I couldn't agree more. So thank you for bringing this bill, and hopefully we're going to build on this and provide proper placements for those kids and those families that need the services that right now they're inaccessible to. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. To Representative Hicks and Representative Nadeau, I understand it too. I mean, this issue of parents feeling like they're being charged essentially with neglect or abuse is the issue that is we're seeing it manifest in every section right now. We have seniors that are going to the hospital and providers can't meet the needs for them to come back because of specific behaviors. And we have to find some solutions because this is happening statewide. All of the hospitals have children that they are holding because there's no place to go. And there are adults they're holding because there's no place to go. And there are seniors because the reality is when there's documented abuse, whoever takes the person into their setting is responsible to protect everybody in this room. And that's a tough charge to do. Right? Because you have knowledge that there's an issue. So for that parent in a home who may or may not have other children, and most of them do, to know that you have somebody who could put other people's lives in danger because they have needs that can't be met in that setting, they want to do the responsible thing. And that's what providers are trying to do in other settings too, is the responsible thing. What is the responsible thing? And the responsible thing isn't happening right now for Minnesota. And so unfortunately, we're seeing this in hospitals across the state. And we have to, as a legislative body, find some serious solutions for their children, for the adults, and for the seniors, because it is a statewide issue that is, there's not a solution right now. And I couldn't agree more that charging people with neglect and abuse when they've done everything they can within their ability is not the answer. Thank you.
Members, I appreciate the discussion on this today. This is a really heart-wrenching issue. Representative Kraft, I appreciate you for bringing it forward. There's no silver bullet, right, to solving our mental health crisis. And as a foster adoptive parent myself, I feel deeply the difficulties that facing children and families all across the state of Minnesota. It's going to take workforce. It's going to take investment. It's going to take just ongoing partnership. And I think that this bill is a huge step in the right direction to make sure that we recognize that these parents are doing all that they can. They're doing the exact opposite of neglecting these children. And they need to be recognized as such. So I'll let you have closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you all closed the bill about as well as I can. I really appreciate that you're all thinking about the root cause issues, and I think those need to be addressed. And this, to me, is a no-brainer that we should do. So thank you.
With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1614, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and you are on your way to Judiciary. Representative Kraft, thank you for being with us, and thank you to the testifiers. Last but not least, we have Vice Chair Hansen with House File 2009. You do have a few testifiers. First on the list is Misty Kuntz. If you want to approach the testifiers table and prepare to offer your testimony when it's time, that would be helpful. All right, Vice Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I move that House File 2009 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
All right.
Is that right? I see Coley nodding.
That is correct. All right. Representative Hansen moves that House File 2009 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, feel free to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about House File 2009 today. This is an appropriation for the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson. This bill represents a critical step towards ensuring the voices of Minnesota's foster youth are not just heard, but also given the necessary attention and support that they need. For a little bit of background for some of the new folks and folks who may have forgotten, the creation of the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, also known as OOFY, is a direct response to the advocacy efforts of those who have experienced foster care right here in Minnesota. After hearing from fosters, it was recognized that an independent agency was needed to oversee the experiences of those in foster care and address any challenges they may face while in care. In 2022, we finally garnered bipartisan support, and this was passed as a standalone bill off the House floor with a very green board and a lot of smiles, with foster youth in the gallery joining us. This office officially opened in early of 2024 to provide direct support to 10,000 foster youth who are currently living right here in Minnesota. Fosters face really unique challenges, and having a dedicated agency to advocate for their rights is an important step in ensuring that they are not overlooked by the systems that are intended to support them. House File 2009 is an appropriation for the office to expand their capacity and their ability to meet foster youth where they live, whether in family foster homes, group homes, residential, and out-of-state facilities. This bill would allow the office to support two FTEs to engage in proactive outreach to ensure that Minnesota fosters are aware of the office's existence as a resource to facilitate efforts and to educate fosters about their rights and empower them to advocate for themselves while in foster care. This proactive approach is really critical in making sure that fosters are fully informed on their rights and are equipped to navigate the foster care system. Fosters cannot advocate for themselves if they do not know that they have these rights and that the office is there for them and that these resources are necessary in helping them learn to advocate for themselves. We have some testifiers here today who can speak to the direct impact that this support could have in connecting with fosters. But I do, if I could indulge, Chair, we have some folks in the audience. Would you, if you worked on this bill back in 2022, would you raise your hand if you were here with us the day that we passed that bill off the House floor? So I want to highlight, if you look in the audience here, these folks have been working on this since the beginning. They showed up to the legislature, made this pitch of this idea to me. They helped garner bipartisan support. They worked for this. And they were there with us when we passed it off the floor. And it was really an honor to get to show them what bipartisanship around supporting foster youth really looks like. So this office is a product of that. So if we can, if you have time to go back and watch that floor hearing, it was very moving. It was probably my favorite day in the legislature. And this is really great because now a number of these folks are working in the office as well. And so the lived experience that's brought right to the office, I think, is really valuable and is something that we should continue to invest in. So these FTEs would really help to continue to get the word out there and really meet kids where they're at. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Ms. Kuntz, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Also, just a fun note, I think that UFI is possibly the best acronym of state government that I've ever heard. So let's keep going.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Misty Kuntz. I am the ombudsperson with the Office of the Foster Youth Ombudsperson, also known as UFI. We agree, and we appreciate that we were gifted the best state acronym. And thank you, Representative Hansen, for giving such a great history and overview of how our office was created and about some of the gaps that it aimed to fill. I'm going to give a little bit of information, but also don't want to take up too much time because we do have some testifiers who are fosters. I also have lived experience in foster care and bring that into my role, as does four of our current six staff at UFI. So UFI's mission is clear. We're here to listen, to inform, to take action, and to make recommendations to improve the lives of all Minnesota foster youth and ensure that they get the highest standard of care. However, we recognize that in order for our office to be effective, our outreach to fosters must be proactive, intentional, and ongoing, not merely reactive. One of the things that makes us unique as a state agency is that we are here to listen to children and youth. We are doing everything we can to make our materials accessible, to make our information accessible to those in foster care so that they can contact us directly. The fosters that we serve are often experiencing instability and isolation from supports. We know this not only from the data that the state collects, but from our own experiences. Based on lessons that we learned from our ombuds colleagues in other states, we know that the most effective outreach to foster youth is through proactive in-person connections. For example, the ombuds office in Texas shared that the vast majority of the concerns brought to their attention occur while doing youth outreach. Our office needs to be able to see for ourselves the conditions of the facilities that our Minnesota foster youth are in and be sure that they can share their concerns with us privately. The office in New Hampshire visited their youth in a Tennessee facility and identified concerns so egregious that the facility was closed. We need Minnesota to follow suit. This appropriation would fully support two full-time positions to conduct outreach to fosters, including in-person visits to facilities in Minnesota and elsewhere. You heard Representative Hicks talking about the number of youth that are placed out of state. All or the majority of them are foster youth. And so they don't have dedicated people calling them every day like the parents that you heard about experiencing some of the really challenging things that they shared in their testimony. What we want to do is make sure that we can connect with fosters, that we can create youth-friendly materials about their rights, and that we can have additional capacity to connect with stakeholders that can help spread the word about our office. When a young person enters foster care, there's no requirement or system in place to ensure that they are informed about their rights and made aware of the resources available to them, including UFI. Getting this information is dependent on whether it is part of their caseworker or attorney's practice. The resources that do exist are not comprehensive, actionable, or accessible, which leaves fosters vulnerable and unable to advocate for themselves when their rights are being violated or when facing other challenges in the foster care system. So because of that, we are asking for a $240,000 increase in our agency's base appropriation to allow us to fully realize our statutory charge in serving and supporting all Minnesota foster youth. Thank you for the chance to speak. I know we have some other testifiers, and we are happy to answer questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Kuntz. Yes, we have Vivian Dudley and Travis Matthews on the list. If you would approach the testifiers table, and Vivian Dudley, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed, followed by Travis Matthews. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you, chairs and members. For the record, my name is Vivian Dudley. I am a foster, a woman of God, a social work student of St. Kate's, and a passionate advocate for my foster community. In preparing to speak before the community today about the importance of educating fosters about their rights and existence of UFI, I reflected on what this could have meant for me. While I was in foster care, I never knew that I had rights as a foster. No one ever told me that when I entered the state, I had additional protections as a young person. No one ever took the time to pause and assure me that my well-being mattered, even if the state was my parent. Looking back, I realized how different my experience could have been if I had known and been informed that I had rights as a foster. Significant aspects of my case could have been changed for the better. I would have known what questions to ask and what to look out for to protect myself from the harm I was experiencing. As a teen parent in foster care, I didn't know I had the right to have custody of my child or to care for her. Had I known, I would have held my workers accountable and felt empowered to advocate for both myself and my daughter. I would have fought for the right to be active in her life, attend her doctor's appointments, and not tolerated being court-ordered to shelters in the middle of a reunification case. As a young person in a complex system, our requests for support and for our needs to be met are often viewed as manipulative, irrational, and emotional responses. They are not met with understanding or reason, but dismissed and belittled. If ever acknowledged, adding more trauma to already turbulent lives. By empowering fosters with knowledge of their rights, it empowers my community to know the standard of care they deserve to receive from the adults charged with the duty of supporting and caring for them. Like many of my peers, I'm here today because of the disadvantages I faced and because I want to ensure no one else goes through what I went through. I believe if I knew the rights that I had, I would still have my daughter to this day. UFI plays an important role in educating fosters and providing a neutral and confidential space for fosters to be truly heard. Had this office and outreach existed during my time of care, I don't think I would have felt so isolated and alone. I believe the ongoing injustices in my case and fellow peers would have not reached the extent that they did. I believe it is crucial for young people to know UFI is here and that the state ensures that office has the capacity to meet fosters where they are at. We need someone to bridge the gap of hope, to remind us that we are important, that we have a voice, and that we deserve care and justice. This office and outreach reminds us that I matter, my daughter matters, my story matters, and so does the stories and experiences of my community, that there are people who are doing everything they can to ensure our well-being and is considered in the chaos. Social workers' roles in the court are to ensure the well-being of a child, a guardian ad litem for the best interest, lawyers to speak on what the youth wants, and the judge to make this ruling. But who's holding everyone accountable for the choices that will affect fosters? With UFI, this will ensure that primary focus stays on fosters, our well-being, and our knowledge, and foster success in the community. In a democracy, the ultimate authority lies within the citizens who have the right to participate in decision-making. I believe this should be no different for fosters in their own lives. Thank you for the opportunity to express my support on this bill, and I urge you to please consider passing this.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Matthews, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, chairs and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Matthews. I'm not here today in my role at Youth Prize, but as a foster in community. I'm 22 years old, and I aged out of Itasca County Foster Care less than 2 years ago. My experience in foster care is pretty vast. I spent time in multiple types of placements, ranging from your traditional foster care to group homes, residential, and detention. Most of these settings were pretty harmful to my development as a child and have permanently altered my life today. I don't think that it's effective to use my time explaining to you about each right that me and my peers had violated. We all know the reality of foster care, hence the creation of this office. There wouldn't need to be oversight if things were going well. They aren't. We have some of the worst outcomes for fosters across the country, and these outcomes are directly tied to the experiences that fosters have while in placement. Early on in foster care, I set out to learn my rights and how to advocate for myself and my peers when things were going wrong. It's why I do the work I do today. People often say it's wonderful that I'm so passionate about policy around foster care, but in reality, I was a very angry foster, frustrated that many of my peers weren't informed of their rights, and nor did staff and placements comply with the policies set by the state agencies and this body. This anger and frustration guided me to help other fosters file grievances and lodge complaints against staff and placements when violating policy and procedure. I often think about why. Why was I, a 14-year-old boy, helping other kids and myself protect ourselves against settings that were meant to be safe? This is the unfortunate reality to be a foster. You will see your peers physically, sexually, and emotionally assaulted by the same people and facilities tasked with the responsibility of protecting you. There shouldn't even be a question if this office exists. The reality is that these placements, while they're a roof over the foster's head, are not the conditions needed to foster the development of or keeping these children safe. Most of these facilities are staffed by underqualified, underpaid, and overworked people, creating unsafe conditions. You can try to create policy that these placements are required to follow, but it doesn't matter if the fosters don't know that they're supposed to be followed. This office needs to be able to inform fosters of the rights they have under the law and how the system can protect them when they are violated. This office is tasked with the responsibility of holding accountability within the child welfare system, a system that is fundamentally broken, and I think we can all agree on that. This is arguably one of the largest tasks, considering the state of Minnesota has failed in holding state and county and local placements accountable. I ask that each of you make the commitment to protecting our foster youth by supporting this funding request to ensure that the Ombuds Office for Foster Youth can fully inform foster youth of their rights and know what to do when they're violated. I hope my testimony today has provided a sliver of insight into the reality that our foster children live in. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today and for sharing your story. That's all the testifiers that we have on the list. Members, we have gone over time. So I just appreciate that we had the opportunity to hear directly from you today. And Representative Hansen, I'll allow you a brief close.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, everybody, for hearing the questions. You know where to find me if you have any questions about this. And the great thing is that I know where to find these foster youth. Yeah. They have my phone number. We stay in touch. They show up at the Capitol, and they are here doing the work. What the skills they've learned really matter. So I partnered with foster youth and fought to responsibly grow government, Chair West, with really good barriers around it, with bipartisan support for all the right reasons. But what good is that if we can't allow them to get the word out there and to make sure that they're in the community doing what they do best? So please continue to support them in their early stages, because this support needs to be amplified to its maximum volume and reach so that UFI can continue to be the watchdogs for our children in foster care and offer those critical supports that foster youth deserve from us. Youth are inherently worthy of dignity, respect, and their own rights. And they want to live whole lives just like anybody else while their stories develop into the beautiful stories like what you've seen here before today. Shout out to the Katie and the social work grad. I'm a Katie and a social work grad. And the roles that we as legislators play in the youth fosters' lives really matters a lot too. So I encourage you to take time to meet with fosters, talk to them, hear their stories, and let them come work in your office. Thanks, Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hansen. With that, we'll lay over House File 2009. And we are adjourned.